near and dear to my heart. I just want to talk for a couple of minutes, take any questions you might have. But you know, science is the lifeblood of our civilization. It's what has made the modern world possible. It's why the planet supports 6 billion people and not several hundred million. It's what has distinguished this modern age. It has tremendous benefits and it carries with it tremendous responsibilities and risks. We in America are the prime beneficiaries and the real carriers of science and technology and the scientific method. We come by it naturally. We came here to this continent, a continent that, according to latest research, was ravaged by diseases that our forebears brought to this continent that may have killed off 90% of the original inhabitants. But we came here and it was an open continent. It only needed the imagination of men and women and their courage and their skill and their hard work to develop it. We were pragmatists by nature. We had a frontier to conquer. We took what we could find from abroad. We brought it in. Ben Franklin was one of our first notable scientists, taming lightning in a bottle brought down from the sky, understanding for the first time, proving that lightning was this magical thing called electricity. And we Americans put together steamboats. We built railroads. We created magnificent bridges, like those incredible pieces of architecture over the East River in Manhattan. We discovered, I said, blessings and risks and problems. We discovered petroleum seeping out of the ground, and it was pretty good. It was almost as good as whale oil for lighting lamps. We developed electric lighting, the telephone. The French disagree with us on this, but I say we developed the airplane. And you go to France, you get the big argument. There was McCormick, Cyrus McCormick, and the whole mechanization of agriculture, which really made possible the American miracle and built our civilization after we passed the Homestead Act. There was Henry Ford and how he took the principle of designing automobiles and then and building them by hand and converted it into something entirely different, the mass production process that has swept around the globe. I think everyone's familiar with what happened in the 1930s in this country when, as a result of the rise of National Socialism in Austria and Germany, a wave of the most incredibly talented men and women in the world came to America, with the result that nuclear energy became not a fantasy, but a reality. And we used it when we had to end a terrible war in the Pacific. And after World War II, we developed the laser. That was ours. Semiconductors, those were ours. The internet. We went from developing penicillin in World War II to the polio vaccine, to cracking the human genome. We put in place things like not only the internet, but the global positioning system, which is soon going to make it possible for you to track your location. And everybody else to track their location all around the country. And it may have started pragmatically, it may have been haphazard, it may have been pushed by human freedom and a little bit of greed and competitiveness and ego, but by the 1950s, this had become a national policy of science and technology. You know, I was a young person, and I'm not the only person with gray hair in this room, but we're probably a small minority of what someone called the internet generation. It's not chronological, you know. And I was in the eighth grade when Sputnik was launched. And I remember this incredible outpouring of fear and concern. And of course, the United States quickly, we had our satellite program too. We had a Navy system called Vanguard, and it was on the launch pad at Cape Canaveral. And Sputnik was a little bitty thing that went around the Earth beeping. So we had our little bitty thing, but it didn't work. And when the satellite took off, it wobbled a little bit and it fell and crashed. was a real comparison that marked for the United States a relative failure in the most important international competition that we could imagine. The struggle of the United States and our principles against a worldwide communist movement that sought to overthrow us, take away what we believed in, our freedoms to choose and live. And so the United States government got very serious about science and technology. We created the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. We passed the National Defense Education Act in Congress in 1958 so that teachers could go to school and learn science and mathematics and have their education supported by the federal government, because we understood that science and mathematics, they were the lifeblood of competing against the godless Soviet Empire. And those young men and women in Russia who were smart and intelligent and trying to be the new Marxist men and women, they couldn't compete with Americans. They couldn't compete with the products of the free enterprise system. And we passed the NDEA, and we were determined to compete and win. We created some incredible things for the National Science Foundation and R&D tax credits and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. I was one of the beneficiaries. I was in the ninth grade in the Little Rock public school system. And I got a note from my homeroom teacher. I've been selected to participate in the Federal Radiation Project. So there were four or five of us from Pulaski Heights and four or five from Forest Heights, and we were taken across town at 3:30 in the afternoon after school a couple of 3 days a week, and we met with Mr. Berry, who was the 10th grade. He was a biology teacher at Hall High School, and we were only in the 9th grade. But this was to give us a jump on those Soviets kids who were learning things. And so what we were taught about, and here's how smart it was. The one thing the Soviets couldn't quite handle was genetics, Mendelevian genetics, because if you understand genetics with dominant and recessive genes, then you have to question whether you can, by the environment alone, create a new form of man. And so in the Federal Radiation Project, they talked to us and they taught us about genetics with the species was Drosophila melanogaster, which is the common fruit fly. And the medium was spoiled bananas. And so Mr. Berry would go to the Kroger's and he'd buy the oldest bananas he could find. He'd come back and they'd mash them up in a test tube. And we would look at these Drosophila melanogasters under a microscope, or actually under a big magnifying glass, and you could see the colors of their eyes and the numbers of wings. And then you'd stuff them into the, let them feed on the banana stuff, and then you'd take them over to the University of Arkansas Medical Center and give them, thousands of Rickens. Rats. He irradiated them. Thank goodness, not us. The irradiation was on the fruit flies, and the idea was, could you mutate the fruit flies? Could you convert yellow eyes into red eyes? And so we spent about 6 weeks on this, and I don't know if we ever produced a new modern fruit fly. I think we produced a lot of sterile fruit flies. But it was a very fertile period for those of us who were engaged in the research, and it really opened our eyes to science. And it also shows that when the country gets behind something, imagine this was done all across America, and the idea was to take those of us who were inclined, intellectually curious, inquisitive, and give us an accelerated opportunity to learn. It was a strategy that we applied all across America. It was competitiveness. It was designed to protect our freedom. And it produced this incredible outpouring of technology that gave us high fidelity. It gave us the chip as we know it. It gave us the internet. It gave us our security and freedom. And it gave us the incredible growth in the economy that we had in the 1990s. All because people in the 1950s and 60s cared enough to invest a very small proportion of what we had into an acceleration of educational effort in science and technology. And today, I'm sorry to tell you, all that is at risk today. And the distinguished members of this panel will go into it in a lot more detail than I will. They'll tell you about the cutbacks in basic research and science. They'll talk to you about the politicization of scientific findings.
whether it's in the Federal Food and Drug Administration or the Office of the White House Science Advisor, whether it has to do with the morning after pill or stem cell research or global warming. It is shocking that the political party that professed to believe in freedom and liberty is trying to impose its political will on the province of science. It's absolutely turned its own principles on its head in the purest demonstration of political hypocrisy you can see in the American stage today. And that is... But what particularly worries me is the conflict that's out there between faith and reason, between faith and science. There's nothing new about this conflict. It's as old as Christianity and even older. It's always been there as men sought to reason their way into an understanding of the world around us, and women sought to reason their way into an understanding of the world around us, and others sought to prevent. Whether it was the Copernican theory of the solar system or Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas in trying to merge faith and reason. It's a long-standing conflict. You know, when I was growing up in Arkansas, everyone read about the Scopes trial in Tennessee in 1924. And that was considered sort of in the 1950s the height of lunacy. And now, what do I find across my beloved South in the United States? I find teachers throughout the area who cannot use the dreaded E-word. I'm not talking about email. I'm talking about evolution. They can't use it. It's like they're quoting a science teacher from my home state in a newspaper. And he says, well, I got these rocks in the classroom, and I'm teaching science, and these rocks, they're pretty old, you know, they're palliative. Metazoic rocks, 200, 300, 400 million years old, and so forth. He says, but I can't say that in the classroom. They say, well, what do you say? He says, I say these rocks, they're very old. Because if I say it, one of these students may go home and say, Daddy, that teacher, he's teaching us something. He's saying stuff's older than the book of Genesis. He's saying it started before 4004 B.C., and he's teaching us stuff that it conflicts with our faith, and he's trying to keep us from having our faith. And across America, well-meaning teachers are running scared. They're running scared because we haven't built for them the kind of support network that lets them fully engage the young minds in their charge, fully deal with natural human curiosity, and provide them access to the facts that our own hard work and labors have created. I mean, imagine, Isaac Newton is relaxing under the apple tree. Now, you know the story, right? There's an apple, and it falls off the tree, and he says, gee, I wonder why that apple fell. And from that comes, you know, the formula for gravity. I think it was like S equals 1/2 AT squared when I was taking physics. But, gravity works at like 16 feet per second. And Newton figured all this out, in the 17th century. But he didn't have to. What he could have said is, I was sitting under the apple tree, and God punished me for relaxing, and so he made an apple fall on my head. And Roy Chapman Andrews, who was one of the real early paleontologists, I was one of those kids, I read all about dinosaurs. Did you ever read that book in the Landmark series for youngsters? I'm dating myself. So Roy Chapman Andrews goes to China in the 1930s and he's picking up rocks and he's looking and he's seeing bones sticking out. And it was when we really began to discover the full extent of the Jurassic era. And Roy Chapman Andrews could have said, I see a bone sticking out, but it's not really a bone. It was put there by God to test my faith in the book of Genesis. He could have said that, but he didn't. Because, you see, I think this is an artificial, manufactured crisis. It's designed by some in authority to maintain their authority over spheres in which they're not competent. I believe there are incredible mysteries in the universe. Mysteries that the mind of man doesn't understand and may never understand. And I see no way in which the advancement of science and the pursuit of knowledge by mankind is in any way threatening to the idea of a supreme being or a great creator. Read Leonard Susskind's new book called The Cosmic Landscape and Intelligent Design, if you want to see something that's overpowering. Susskind is the inventor of cosmic string theory. And what he does is he takes the idea of the universe. He says, the universe is, see what's happening in intelligent design is people are saying, you see, the wavelength of the electron and Planck's constant and all of these numbers are so odd. They're not even numbers, you know. They don't balance each other. It's sort of one point. It's like the figure of pi, 3.14159, blah, blah, blah. Why would it be such an odd number? Why wouldn't God make the universe, you know, symmetrical? And then they say, well, because, you know, it's like there's only 1 in 10 to the 50th chance that the universe could have worked out in a way that mankind could survive. Therefore, you know, this must have been an intelligent designer who created this universe, especially for us. What Susskind does, he turns it on its head. He says, you know, if you look at string theory in the 9 plus 1 dimensions or 10 plus 1 dimensions, and I'm not sure how he knows that time only has one dimension, but he does. And some of the physicists have said I'm very arrogant for questions. But what Susskind does, he turns it upside down and says, look, there is an infinite number of universes. He calls it a multiverse. And he says that, however the motive forces, and nobody understands why quarks pop in and out of existence. Nobody understands it, but apparently they do. And apparently there are many, many universes, and we're here in this one. And maybe there are others in which Planck's constant has a different number, in which the speed of light is 186,200 miles per second. Who knows? We don't know. There's incredible mystery out there. But what I believe is that God did create us and put us on this earth to use what He gave us, which is our imagination, our intelligence, our hands, our eyes, our ears, to study, to learn, to create. And we must do that. We must do it because it's in our nature as human beings to push beyond the frontier, to ask the impossible questions. We can't be any other way. We're no different than our ancestors 1,000 generations ago who gnawed on the bone of the woolly mammoth, threw it into the fire, stumbled out of the cave, lay on their back and looked up at the stars and said, what are those specks of light? And I think that we're closer and closer to finding out. And I think that's our destiny. And I think God wants it that way. Thank you.
Help us put this together.
into a new national strategy of competitiveness. Because there are big problems ahead for this country if we don't create a new national strategy of investing in our young people, in science and technology. We simply have to do it. And we need your support and your leadership to make it happen. We can do it. We can take this country forward again. We can create a new golden age of innovation and science and technology in America. There are whole worlds of knowledge waiting to be discovered in nanoscience, in human science, in physics, in material science, and in all of the applications that can make life better and safer and more humane for all of us. But only if we open our eyes, only if we acknowledge the reality of the condition we're in, only if we beat back the challenges that come from well-meaning people of faith who argue against the very kind of exploration that God gave us the power to do, we have to take back our world and advance the frontiers of knowledge. That is our destiny. That's why you're here at this panel. And now that we're talking about it, we're going to get a lot more information on what we say. You all get out and help us do it. It's about action.